There is a time for everything, a season for every activity under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to collect them, a time to embrace and a time to refrain, a time to search and a time to give up, a time to keep and a time to give, a time to tear and a time to mend, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What does the worker gain from his toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He also has set eternity in the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. The pattern of working 7 days, of having a week that runs 7 days, of working six and resting one, the pattern of a weekend and a weekday, is very deep in our psychology. Seemingly irrational. I mean, why not have a 10-day week, or a 6-day week, or an 8-day week, or a 3-day week? We go for 7-day weeks, and it's hard to move out of the pattern and the routine and the regularity of it. Those of us who love work, those of us who find satisfaction and significance and fulfillment in our work, we're easily tempted into becoming workaholics, into finding life's meaning and purpose, in finding ourselves in the things that we do in those 6 days of work. Indeed, stretching our 6 days into 7, if not 8. Stretching our 8 hours into 9, if not 10, if not 12. Yet for many people, work is just alienating. It's boring. It's difficult. It's hard. It's sweat of the brow country. The word Mondayitis captures our real feeling about the subject of work. Work is the thing that interrupts our weekends. Work is where we discuss what we did last weekend as we plot out what we will do next weekend. Work is the dreadful thing you have to endure. I remember working as a bus conductor in university vacations years ago, and they just received the 6 weeks holiday. And someone had returned from their 6 weeks holiday, a driver I was working with, and so I asked him how he got on and whether he got bored. And he said, no way. He said, I'm working so that we can establish through the union 46 weeks a year holiday and 6 weeks work. His only complaint was his money ran out after the 2nd week. It's a little detail of life, I'm sure. But for him, work was endurance. The pattern of work, of working and of resting, comes from us out of Genesis chapter 2, at the end of the creation account of really chapter 1. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. But the 7th day, God had finished the work he had been doing, so that on the 7th day he rested from all his work, and God blessed the 7th day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating he had done. It's more than just about the weekly pattern. It's about the whole meaningfulness of the universe, of the fact that the universe is going somewhere. The history of the world is not caught up in pure materialism. The materialist sees that every day is exactly the same. There is no time difference from one day to another day, and therefore every day's activities are exactly the same. There really ultimately is not a time to dance and a time to mourn, a time to rejoice, and there's not a time to weep. There's not a time that is any different to any other time. Every minute of the time is exactly the same time. There can be no distinction. It is built into the creation concept that God, who is outside the world, establishes that there is a time for this and a time for that. Because there is eternity as well as creation. Because God, having worked for 6 days, rested the 7th day and established there something more profound than that we should work 6 days and rest 1 day, has established that the world and its meaning has a 7th day to it. That the world and its meaning comes from outside the mechanics of it operating. That the world is going somewhere. It's not just revolving on its own axis around the sun, endlessly heading to nowhere. There is a rest day. God's act of creation comes to an end in God resting. And that day upon which he rests, he marks out as the special day, as the holy day, as the blessed day, as the ultimate good day. As you read through chapter 1, you would think that you come to the pinnacle of creation in man. He and he alone of all the created beings is made in the image of God. Male and female, God made them to have dominion over the world. And here we see the one for whom the world was made, the one with whom God relates, for mankind alone is in the image of God. But the account doesn't end there. It goes on to finish the account in terms of God resting. It's not an anti-climax, it's not a denouement, it's not a kind of shriveling off and finishing it. No, this is actually the high point. That in the end, God sees all that he has done and rests from all that he has done. For the creation is purposeful of God. He has created it for someone, someone with whom he relates. But the end point of creation is not man. Strangely, it's the Sabbath. That the meaning and purpose and direction is not found inside creation. The meaning and purpose and direction is found outside of creation in God, in God's rest. And it is when man enters into that rest with God that man comes to the final point for which the whole creation is made. When Jesus comes into the world as the perfect man, as the one who is now the image of the invisible God, it is not surprising that he comes as a worker. He doesn't come as the philosopher king. He doesn't come as the military general. He doesn't come as the statesman. But he comes as a worker, because from the beginning we have God revealed to us as a worker. He works in creation. But God not only works, he also rests. In Exodus we're taught he abstained from his work and he rested. It's an extraordinary idea, which, because we're very familiar with Genesis 2, we take for granted. But you ponder it for a moment, that God knocks off. He rests. He relaxes. That is, that his work does not consume the whole of his existence. The whole of God's existence is not taken up by work. He creates and he rests. And he marks out the 7th day especially as a good, because it's his rest day. It's to be the day of refreshment. Unlike the Babylonian culture, which saw the 7th day as the evil day, we see the 7th day as the good day. Our pagan superstition sees the 13th as a bad day, especially if it's a Friday for some peculiar and strange reason, a totally irrational thing and a nonsense anyway. But within Babylonian culture, the 7th day is a very bad one. But within the Bible, the 7th day is the good day. Because the 7th day is the day when God knocks off from his work. It's a marvellous feeling to knock off from your work, isn't it? It's a marvellous feeling when you've set yourself a task to do and you've been working away at it and you finally, it's finished. And you can put your pen down and you can relax. There's hardly any moment of the existence which is a nicer moment, is there? When you put your pen down, when you put your shovel down, when you put your whatever it is that you work with down, and you can sit back and you can have yourself a drink, and you can have yourself at that point a good meal, you can have a sleep, you're free. There's a sense of liberty at that moment when you can enjoy the work of your hands. when you can enter into the fruit of the labor that you've put in, when you can actually enjoy living itself. God is one who knows that. It's not like the materialist, you see. For every day is the same for him. All the time is the same for him. Work must never come to an end. In the Old Testament, the Sabbath is picked up several different ways. Firstly, the whole community of Israel is commanded to rest. The seventh day, they are to rest. And the seventh year, they are to rest. You know it, of course, from the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, as I've unfortunately called it in one of these outlines here. But you listen to it as it comes in Exodus 23. It's not just the seventh day. Exodus 23, I'm picking up. For 6 years you are to sow your field and harvest the crops, but during the seventh year let the land lie unploughed and unused. Then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they leave. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days do your work, but on the seventh day do not work, so that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the slave born in your household and the alien as well may be refreshed. Every 6 days, every 6 years, we work. And all that we're involved in our household work. But the seventh day, the seventh year, we rest. For the sake of relaxation, for the sake of refreshment, for the sake of enjoyment, for the sake of taking the benefit of all the labour that we've put in, for the sake of doing good to those around about us and to those who are under us in our household. The ox and the everybody needs the relaxation, the rest. But the seventh day becomes more than that. It becomes a symbol, a sign, that these are the covenant people of God. And so in Exodus 31, verse 13, we read, "Say to the Israelites, you must observe my Sabbaths. This will be a sign between me and you for the generations to come, so you may know that I am the Lord who makes you holy. Observe the Sabbath because it is holy to you." The people of Israel are to keep celebrating the Sabbath, to keep observing the Sabbath, to keep knocking off each Sabbath as a sign that they are God's people. It's a funny sign, isn't it? You see, we would want to put a sign around our necks, like a little idol of some kind. We would want to put around a sign which says, "I am one of God's people," a little cross, a little dove, a little Star of David, whatever it may be. But we hang a sign that the sign of being God's people, or one of the signs of being God's people, is that on the seventh day you knock off from your work, because that's like God. Because you do not find your meaning and purpose in the work that you are doing, you find your meaning and purpose in God, who knocks off from his work every seventh day. And so it was a sign for them of being one of God's people. But the Old Testament uses the Sabbath in another way, in another direction. The Sabbath actually becomes the promised land, the land of inheritance. And so when they are travelling across the wilderness, heading towards the promised land, God promises that he will give them rest. Rest from their enemies. Rest in the promised land. They will enter into the fruit of God's labour. They will go and live in a land of milk and honey, a land where they haven't planted the vineyards, a land where they haven't established the flocks, a land where they will benefit from God's work and from other people's work, but it's a land of rest, a land of refreshment. That is the point of the great Psalm 95, which those of us raised on our morning prayer services know very well, because it was read every morning prayer service. When you hear his voice, "Do not harden your hearts, as in the day of testing, in the wilderness, when God tested it, and when the people put God to the test. Their sinfulness was such that God said they will never enter the promised land." And as the psalmist says it, they will never enter my rest. God's rest for the people of Israel as they toiled across the wilderness for those 40 years, God's rest was Israel. This is necessary to understand if we're going to understand the division in the Decalogue. I'm sorry I use the word. It means the 10 words or the 10 commandments. The 10 commandments are recorded to us twice in the scriptures. Once in Exodus chapter 20 and once in Deuteronomy chapter 5. And of course, being the Ten Commandments, they're the same. Except on the subject of the Sabbath. In Exodus, the reason you are to obey the Ten Commandments is because God created the world in 6 days. Sorry, the reason you are to obey the Sabbath and keep the Sabbath is because God worked 6 days and rested one in the creation. In Deuteronomy, the reason that you are to observe the Sabbath day is because you were a slave in Egypt once, and you know what it's like to be freed from your work. It's strange that the Ten Commandments, written on stone, given to Moses on the mountain, should come in two different forms. Of course, the simplistic enemies of the Word of God say, here is a contradiction, here is an error in the Scriptures, they cannot be believed or trusted. But if you reflect about the Sabbath and what is meant by it, you see that it's really saying the same thing. That the Sabbath is God's eternal purpose for us. It is the end point. That through the trials, the tribulations, the hard pressure of work, we are to come to a time of rest. That God has created this world for the rest, when we will enjoy in relaxation and refreshment the good things that God has made. Having made his world, he rested. And he works out that rest for the people of God through rescuing them out of their hard labour down in Egypt and bringing them to his land flowing with milk and honey, where they can finally put up their feet and enjoy themselves in the good things that God has created for them to enjoy. The people of God will come to the Sabbath rest when they come to the promised land. But as Hebrews chapter 3 points out, they don't get there. What difference did the New Testament make? What difference did Jesus make? Well, much. Firstly, he corrects the Pharisees and their legalistic misunderstanding of the Sabbath, one that is very current even in our society today, even fostered by Christianity. There are a whole series of conflict stories we find in the Gospels between Jesus and the legalists about the rules and regulations of Sabbath observance, of what you can do, and more importantly, what you can't do on the Sabbath day. Prohibitions, negative rules, are always easiest to make. You're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. Christians needn't point the finger at the Sabbath, the Pharisees at this point, as if we haven't done the same. We've done exactly the same. In fact, as one cynic put it, we have turned the commandment, thou shalt not work on Saturday, into thou shalt not play on Sunday. It's the character of our view of Sabbatarianism that it's all rules about how not to enjoy yourself, when the very day is set up that you may enjoy yourself, that you can knock off your hard labour in order to enter into the joyous gifts of God, the good things that God has given us, to refresh ourselves, to relax, to enjoy, is the very nature of the Sabbath. To do good, to live, is of the Sabbath. And to make up hundreds of rules about all the things we're not to do on the Sabbath is to miss the point very severely. One such argument is strange for us, because in John chapter 5, when Jesus heals on the Sabbath, he is attacked for his work and for the sake that a man who has been healed is now carrying his bed away. And Jesus says, my Father is always at work. It's strange because in Genesis 2, you see, he ceases from his work. Again, those with simple flat earth Bible reading mentality see here the contradiction. But we need to ponder as to what it is being said. When it says God ceases from his work, it doesn't mean that he moves into inactivity. That's not what is being said. God is not inactive because he sustains the world. He continues to look after it. He is working in redemption of the world. Indeed, if God moved into total inactivity, the whole world would fall apart in a moment. The only reason we continue to exist the way we are is because God keeps his eye upon us, because God continues to sustain us. Every minute of every day, God continues to uphold his creation. His work of making new may not be continuing. The character of his work will change. The enjoyment of the work that he has already done, he has entered into. But he continues to work on the Sabbath in bringing good, in saving, in healing. For the Sabbath is to save life. The Sabbath is to do good. The Sabbath is to enjoy the good things of this world. We mustn't seek the Sabbath as total inactivity. as total doing nothing. As if we could see somebody lying beside us and not bend down to pick them up. And so Jesus argues that he is the one who is the Lord of the Sabbath in the midst of these controversies in Mark's Gospel. He is the one who is to bring the Sabbath blessings to the people of God, to bring the Sabbath day to God, to bring the rest, the inheritance to the people of God. He is the one for whom the Sabbath has been made. He is the Lord of the Sabbath. And the Epistle to Hebrews, in that passage that was read for us, picks up many of these themes. You see, if the people of God had entered into the great Sabbath rest when they arrived in Palestine under Joshua, then David would not still be warning them about the rest to come. For hundreds of years later, David writes Psalm 95 and says, "Listen to the word of God, or you will not enter the rest." Palestine is a symbol of heaven. The rest that God gave to the Israelites at that point is a symbol of the rest that we will enter into when we come into the relationship with God in heaven. The rest is not the promised land, the rest is not finished, the rest is now and is to be looked forward to. So in Revelation chapter 14, the ultimate state of the Christian, the final point, is when we rest from our labour. For that is what the Spirit says, "Blessed are those who rest from their labour." So how do we participate in the rest of God? Well, firstly, it's the way the world is created. There is a great error abroad that is being propagated by large companies for junior executives to swallow, till they become senior executives and force it upon junior executives just before their heart attacks. That is that we must find ourselves in the work that we do. That my meaning for existence, my rationale for existence, what makes me a worthwhile person is the work that I do, is my career, is my... And once you swallow that assumption, once you swallow that bill of goods, then, of course, you will work very, very hard. Because the harder you work, the more you achieve. The more you achieve, the greater you are as a person. The more significant you become. The more worthwhile is your very life. And the more debilitating is the idea of retirement. And the more difficult you come to be living with as husband or wife. Finding yourself in your work is really one of the latest day idolatries, which doesn't understand that God rested from his work and his rest day was the good day. Mind you, there are others who are so alienated by work that they want to find all in their rest, where God is one who works. The balance between working and resting is normal and is healthy and is important to maintain. We mustn't feel guilty about resting, but enjoy it. We mustn't get caught up in being workaholics. Nor must we see that we are excused from in any way working because God himself is a worker. Nor must we see that work is somehow beneath our dignity. For we are given the dominion of the world to rule over, subdue, to care for. Work is part of our very nature and being. That is, I am more than my work or my rest, and life is more than my work and my rest. But I will not see what that is unless I look to God. Without God, there is nothing more to life than work and rest. And how they're kept in balance, no one knows. And our society has terrible trouble keeping them in balance and terrible trouble making any sense of life. For although we have eternity in our hearts, we cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. We cannot see what gain there is from our work. It is, as Ecclesiastes says, meaningless. I know there's a meaning out there because I know there is a time for work and a time for rest. I know there's a time to gather and a time to scatter. I know there's a meaning out there, but I don't know what the meaning is. So I just keep doing it. I just keep doing it, hoping one day somewhere someone will explain to me the meaning, but not wanting ever to listen to God, lest the meaning is that I've got to live for Him. But God's rest is more than just that we knock off one day in seven. It certainly isn't caught up in rules and regulations as the fact that you're not allowed to hang your washing out on the Sabbath or something like that. God's rest is much more than that. Disobedience to Him excludes us from relationship with Him. Unbelief in His word excludes us from coming to that rest that lies ahead. If we will not listen to His word, we will not enter into the rest for which He has created the whole world. The whole thing has been created for this great rest day that lies ahead. And in Jesus' death and resurrection, He has opened up for us that rest day, so that now as we wander across the wilderness, we are heading somewhere, not nowhere. We're not just heading week in, week out, year in, year out, superannuation grave. We're not heading nowhere. We're heading somewhere. To that rest that lies ahead, which we can already taste as we come to know God as our Father through Jesus, death and resurrection. By accepting the Lord of the Sabbath, we can accept, believing in the word of God, we now enter into that rest. And each week, when we take our day off, we're having a little taste of heaven already, a little anticipation of what lies ahead. And if we do not take our day off, we are losing sight of heaven and thinking to ourselves, all that matters is this world. Every week is a foretaste of heaven. Every week symbolically tells us and reminds us again that there's more to life than this life. There's the life to come. And that one is the important one. This but the preparation for it. Well, there's strange concepts in the Sabbath one. Maybe strange to you, maybe old hat to you.